Computer, initialize holosuite.
Good evening, and welcome to another episode of The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Perry.
And I'm your host, David. Tonight we're talking about Season 2, Episode 1, The Homecoming. Before we continue, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts as The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast.
Absolutely, and you should find us because this season is going to be even better than what we did last season. Got some stuff planned for us down the pipeline, and you're going to want to tune in for that. And best way to do that is not only to listen to us, but also to follow us on Twitter all the time. Ask the Fire Caves. Just give me a quick search, and we'll get all your questions, comments, concerns, everything here. So hit us up. Now, before we jump into Season 2, David, how you feeling coming into Season 2 of this podcast?
Yeah, it's amazing that we were able to get through Season 1. I mean, I know looking back, I can remember every time we recorded and everything we did, and it's been enjoyable, but it feels like it was just yesterday we started this little adventure together, and here we are on a Season 2, and yeah, ready to keep going.
Me too. I mean, I am excited. Like, as always, you know, any chance I get to talk about Star Trek, I'm going to jump on it, but Deep Space Nine is my absolute favorite, and I feel like we're finally going to be getting into more of the things that I really love about the show, much more of the story building. And of course, as always, I will be bringing us some relevant details about the 90s from when the show was airing and the cultural references and political and social and everything else that was going on during the 90s that may or may not have influenced the show as it was being written and put together and filmed for us, of course. So stay tuned for that and get yourself a little a little real life history while we do Trek history as well.
Very nice.
Yes, yes. So, anything new for you planned in February?
Well, I'm finally going to pick up that bike of mine. I might have mentioned that. It's ready for me, but I have to go get it. And unfortunately, work kind of got in the way of me being able to go by and get it this week. But I hope by this time next week, I'll be able to tell you I have it. It's great, and I've had a chance to start really enjoying it. But yeah, just around the corner. Should have it soon. Just not yet. So when I do, you'll be the first to know.
Well, great. And as always, I am just continuing my own little fitness journey here. Trying to be healthier in the new year and keep that going for more than just the first month. I recently signed up to participate in the February American Cancer Society push-up challenge. So for the month of February, you're supposed to do, I believe it's 25 push-ups a day. So not hard. Wow. You could knock out 25 push-ups, you know, in just a few minutes. It's not that big of a deal, but I'm going to be talking more about that as we go through the month. Of course, it's a great fundraiser that they do. In addition to other fundraisers like the Relay for Life, which I've participated in for a good number of years. So trying to get back into doing more things like that. And hopefully, you know, we can just keep that going.
Perfect. So, yeah, sounds good.
So tonight, now that we're done with our non-Trek news, as David said, we are talking about Season 2, Episode 1, Homecoming. And I am just so excited for Season 2. And you don't even have to worry. I will be recapping this episode for us because it's awesome.
Just go for it.
It's awesome. All right. So, as we said, we're talking about Homecoming. So, this episode is our season opener. And it opens on two of our favorite characters, Odo and Quark in Quark's bar. And it's Odo kind of sneaking up on Quark from the shadows. Quark is focused on doing something else. And all of a sudden, you hear that raspy, grumbly voice of Odo coming up behind him. Yeah. And, you know, he stops Quark from wherever it is he's going, and he's questioning him about some information that Quark had given him about a potential smuggling operation that was going on. Yeah. And at first you're wondering what's up, because why would Quark be given such information to Odo? And it turns out that that the information that Quark gave Odo was correct. There was a smuggling operation going on, and Odo was surprised. And so he's like, yeah, I arrested them and impounded the cargo. And he's like, I just don't know why you did it. And he's, and Quark's like, well, I've decided that from now on, you and I are going to be friends. Which, of course, Odo is not having. He's not buying it at all. And he's like, yeah, right. And so, you know, they kind of have their little going back and forth in which the Quark is telling them, you know, he's just trying to change their relationship and do things better. And Odo pretty much ends it with, yeah, I'm watching you. And that's that's their thing. And so, you know, then Rom, Quark's brother, shows up, and he's just like, I don't know why you would tell him that either. You know, and he's and that's when we hear one of our famous rules of acquisition.
Yep.
In which he tells him it is the 76th rule of acquisition, which is every once in a while, declare peace. It confuses the hell out of your enemies.
That's right. So,
and as we will soon discover, I love the rules of acquisition. There are 286 of them. So we'll see if we hear all of them or not during the run of the show. But I just love this little exchange between them. But it also got me thinking more about the rules of acquisition, because it's like, if all the Ferengi follow these, anytime anybody would employ this one, would you not be confused? You would also know what's going on.
Right.
So I don't know if that would work. Anyway, I digress. We now move on to where Quark, we find out where Quark was actually going. There is an attractive alien female captain on the upper deck of his bar, and she has a mysterious looking Bajoran earring. And she's saying that someone gave it to her to take to Bajor, but because of her business, she's not going to be able to make it to Bajor. And she was wondering if Quark knew someone she could give the earring to. And Quark's like, yeah, I'll take it. He takes the earring off her hands. He then goes to Major Kira's quarters. We see Kira in there. It's very dark. She appears to be praying. She answers the door. Quark comes in. He shows her, after a little bit of teasing, he shows her the earring, which immediately changes her demeanor. Something about this ring, this earring, is very significant, so much so that she storms out of her quarters, leaving Quark in there.
Yeah.
So this place that at first she didn't want him to be at all, now she doesn't even care. She runs out.
Yep.
So she leaves with the earring. And then we find her, obviously she headed to find Captain Sisko, Commander Sisko, sorry, and he was on the promenade. Now, at this time, Sisko is on the promenade, and Jake has found his father. Jake showing up for the first time in the season wearing one of his spectacular, awful jumpsuit things that they have this kid in, which I will, Jake's fashion will always be a sticking point for me on this show. But anyway, Jake, in their little side story here, Jake is now at dating age, and he has decided to ask out someone, and Ben mistakenly thinks that his son has come to ask him for dating advice. And then we find out that Jake really doesn't need any advice, because he's already asked, and the girl has said yes. And the girl has said yes, so apparently young Sisko's got moves.
Right.
So, you know, Ben's kind of taken aback by that, but, you know, his son is asking him, he's asking for a different kind of advice, what to do on the date. And so he suggests going to the Hollow Suites, which now we know that is a no-no.
No.
Which, again, this goes to show us kind of a difference in the way that Hollow Suites and holodecks are treated, because on the Enterprise, everyone was in the holodecks all the time. Wesley Crusher was in the holodecks all the time. And even when our show starts, when Deep Space Nine starts, we find Jake Sisko, very young, by himself in the holodeck on the ship that they're on that's taking them to Deep Space Nine. But now that they're on the holosuites on the space station, apparently the connotation for the holodeck has changed.
Right.
And so, no, he's saying, you are too young, take a girl to the holosuites. And then yeah. his next suggestion is to go back to their quarters. And he's like, even worse. Yep. You're not doing yeah. that. So then it's basically like, you know, find somewhere to walk around, watch the wormhole, something like that. And Jake's like, yeah, you know what? I'll figure this out. You're pretty lame, Dad. I got
yeah.
this.
Yeah.
They're interrupted by Kira, who is very, you know, insistent. She's very eager. And this doesn't seem to really faze Sisko at all. He's very much locked in on this exchange with his son. And right. from what I can kind of gather, it also seems to be pretty early in the day. So Sisko is on his way to have breakfast. He's got he gets coffee, he gets his little cake thing, and now he's finally getting into whatever it is that Kira wants, which, you know, her having to cool her heels a bit, you can see kind of her enthusiasm waning. It drops down a little bit.
Right.
She asks Sisko for a runabout. He says, what for? She tells him. He's like, I kind of wish you hadn't told me.
Yeah, now she first tells him, like, I don't want to tell you what this is for because you're not going to like it. He's like, you right. got to tell me anyway.
I already yeah. asked. And now he's like, I wish I hadn't asked, because he found out why she wants it. She's saying that there's a Bajoran prisoner. His name is Lee Nalis, who is apparently mm-hmm. this very famous resistance leader who was supposedly killed, but his body was never found. And now here's this earring that turns up with his DNA on it that she already got proven by Dax. It is his DNA. So he must be on this other planet, Cardassia 4. And she right. wants to take the runabout to go get him. He has to think it over because he recognizes that this could be a political hotbed moment here, could really upset some things, and he just wants to make sure he's got all his ducks in a row. He ends up talking to Dax about it. Dax points out to him that, hey, according to the armistice, the agreement, the Cardassians were supposed to have returned all their Bajoran prisoners anyway. So right. what would they say to them since they, you know, since clearly they still have Bajoran prisoners?
Right.
So Sisko realizes, okay, she's right. And so he's going to allow her to take the runabout. Right. Now, also, before this, you know, before Sisko decides, he and Odo are called by O'Brien to a obscure section of the station where there is some graffiti that's on the wall. They recognize right. the graffiti. They announce that it is with a group called The Circle, which is a organized xenophobic group that has sprung up recently on Bajor. There's a lot of political and social unrest going on the planet right now, and there seems to be a resurgence in, again, xenophobia and nationalism. They believe in Bajor for the Bajorans. They want yes. any aliens, outsiders, and so forth gone. This is in direct, you know, basically, this is coming from them being an oppressed people for the past 50 years. They don't trust outsiders because, again, last outsiders that came in there pretty much raped and pillaged and destroyed their planet. So, right. to a degree, kind of understandable. But as us outsiders who are supposed to be represented as the Federation, this is problematic, to say the least.
Right.
So, knowing all of this and knowing that the unrest is only getting worse, this is another reason why Sisko grants Kira's request to take the runabout to go and get Lee Nalis. Because Kira believes, and she's pretty much convinced Sisko, that if there's anybody who can reunify Bajor, it is the great Lee Nalis.
Right.
So, Sisko agrees, but on the condition that she takes Miles O'Brien with her.
Right.
O'Brien, dressed in his civilian skivvies, goes with right. Kira on this mission. They have a brief run-in with the Cardassian Patrol, but it's nothing that they can't talk their way out of.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. Which makes me think Cardassians are incredibly stupid. I mean, you couldn't plug in the name. She tells him Gol Moraine is waiting on a shipment of seeds.
Right. And
that... he'd be really upset if they were late for some minor issue. And the Cardassian right. on the other end just accepts it and lets him right. through. Like, you couldn't take 2 seconds to plug that name in to see if there is actually a Gol Moraine, let alone one listed on the planet she just told you they were going to. Like, no security check whatsoever. Either they're just really, really dumb or they're really, really lazy. So I don't know where that falls. Probably. But yeah, but I mean, it was, to me, I was like, seriously, I can do that now. Someone gives me a name, Google search, 2 seconds, I got it. You mean to tell me they couldn't do the same thing here? But again.
Was Google invented by this time that Deep Space Nine was out? I mean.
Well, we'll have to double check on that. Because, well, I know obviously the internet was, but I don't know if Google was a search engine yet.
Yeah.
This would have been 1994. Right. And I wonder if Google was out. I think Google came out in 95, so we can always go back and check that. That'd be a great little 90s tie-in. Anyway.
1998, for the record.
Oh, well, there you go. So, no.
Yeah.
There was not Google yet.
Yeah.
But in the future, Google would have existed for centuries, so they should still have this already.
They should have thought ahead already. Yeah.
So, Kira and O'Brien make it to the planet, Cardassia 4. It's a prison camp is there, and they decide to use the ruse of she's a prostitute and he's her pimp to get through the security barrier so that they can find Lee Nellis. This works, and once again, Cardassian's really dumb. He just he never even attempts to search her, nothing. Yeah. He just lets her through the force field, lets her get real close.
And he's like, I want to taste the merchandise for myself. Yeah. So it's like, wow, this is a really easy ruse to pull on you, isn't it?
And it worked. She got in real close, and then she beats the hell out of him. And then she knocks the force field down. O'Brien comes in. They start shooting up a bunch of people. They find Lee Nellis. They rescue Lee Nellis. Some of the other prisoners end up staying behind because there's just too many Cardassians to unarmed Bajorans, and the whole point is to get Lee out of there. So they stay behind, but a good portion of them get on the runabout and hightail it back to Deep Space Nine. When they get back to Deep Space Nine, Kira bursts into Sisko's office, and she's ready to tell him about the success. However, there's prisoners left behind, but she's interrupted because on the screen is none other than Gul Dukat, our infamous Cardassian leader. And he is telling her about how they had just recently discovered, unbeknownst to everybody conveniently, that they were shocked to discover there were still Bajorans being held in labor camps.
But
we've righted this wrong, and they're on a ship to Bajor as we speak. And we hope that their rapid response to this gross oversight will further show their commitment to continued peace.
And they're no longer your enemies.
And yes, no longer your enemies. Yeah, so great. You were holding these people for, like, 10 additional years and enforced servitude, slavery, and torture. But yeah, you're committed to peace.
Right.
Good guy, Dukat. Anyway. So, now Lee is back. Lee Nellis is back. They take care of the surviving people. They're rushing them off to sick bay. Lee Nellis was shot during the rescue attempt. And now he's in sick bay with Dr. Bashir. He gets his wounds treated, and we see him finally taking some of the bandages off for the first time. And he's basically just like, you know, I'm just tired. And he just kind of sounds like he just really wants to be done with things.
Right.
He's later seen walking around the station with Commander Sisko, and a crowd is gathering around him because everybody knows who he is. He's very famous. At the same time, the First Minister of Bajor comes on board the station to greet Lee Nellis. He is Minister Jaro Asa, is his name. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And he is he's greeted by Kira. And at first, he reprimands her because she had initially sought approval to do this through the Bajoran government. They told her no. She then went behind their back and did it anyway. He's telling her, you know, don't ever do that again or your career will be over. But as a private citizen, I just want you to know that, like, I'm elated that you did this. Thank you for bringing Lee Nellis back to us.
Right.
So then Kira and Jaro meet Sisko and Lee Nellis on the promenade. And after Lee gives his speech about how glad he is to be free and to be home, Minister Jaro interrupts him and kind of takes over, doing his whole sleazy politician posturing and schmoozing, which I think everybody in the know, anyway, the officers and so forth, they kind of recognize what he's doing, but no one says anything because, again, Lee Nellis is like, I don't want to have anything to do with any of this.
Right.
So now the next thing that we see is
Sisko takes Lee Nellis to his quarters. Room.
Yes.
Right.
And Lee is not so much taken aback by the size of the room. He's just like, I'm just glad to have a moment's peace, to have some privacy, haven't any privacy in a while. And Sisko's like, enjoy it, but don't get used to it. As you can see, there's a lot of stuff that's going on right now. We could really use you. So just, you know, be aware.
Right.
You know, and they kind of leave it there. The next thing we see is Quark and Rom. They're in the bar, and apparently it's payday. And Quark is doing the count for the payout. One yes. for Rom and six for him. And this continues. One for Rom and six for Quark. And Rom eventually gets very fed up with this, calls Quark out on the unfair distribution of wealth, and Quark absolutely agrees, and he says, all right, we're going to change it up. You're totally right. One for you and seven
for me. And Rom just walks off. He just leaves his money there.
Yeah, that's the thing. He just left his money. And so now that he's gone and Quark continues to count, Quark is now alone, which leaves him open to attack, and he is assaulted. A group of cloaked individuals grab him, hold him still while they brand him on one of his frontal lobes with the symbol
for... Not your lobes, but no, like his forehead, kind of.
Yeah, the lobe of his head with the symbol for the circle. Right. Then we see him in sickbay trying to get it treated, which, again, the people from the circle just, they don't seem really smart to me. You attacked him, sure, but the treatment for it is quick.
Immediately.
They wipe it away, and it's like it never happened. I mean, sure, he's a little traumatized, but I mean, it's like it never happened. Scars gone.
Right.
Okay, so, you know, Lee Nullis and Sisko and Odo, they're asking questions. What happened? They're realizing it's from the circle. They're realizing the circle is more organized than the government is. So this is not really a shock to her, to Kira, you know, and they're saying that it's more because the Bajorans are looking for a new leader. They're looking for Lee. She's like, Lee is it. He's the guy. We really need him to, you know, kind of step into this this role.
Yeah.
Sisko then leaves, and we see him returning to his quarters, where he finds his son. And his son is very upset. And he's asking Jake what's going on. And apparently, the girl that he was supposed to go on the date with, she had to cancel because her father said that she did not want her dating Jake because Jake is not Bajoran.
Right.
Now, Sisko tries to console his son. He's trying to get him to understand that, you know, you don't deserve being treated this way, but these are just, you know, how people start to think and react because of what's going on, you know. And, you know, he's trying to be gentle with his son, but you can tell that it kind of, you know, it's hurtful to him to recognize this kind of prejudice is now, it's gone beyond just his job. It's now affecting his personal life, his son as well. So we get that as well. Okay. Sisko was then interrupted, and he's contacted by another alien captain, and they were getting ready to leave the station when they found a stowaway on board their ship. And the stowaway is none other than Lee Nullis. The hero is trying to run away.
Uh-oh.
So now Sisko has to go and confront him and figure out what the heck is this guy doing. So he does, and Lee now tells him the story of how he became Lee Nullis. And so it's the story about him and his resistance group, and they were in this, had been running and gunning from the Cardassians on Bajor for a while. They were now hiding out in this area and had been stuck there for quite some time. They'd run out of food, they run out of water, they were just pretty much at their wits' end when they finally decided to leave their hiding place because they were starving, and to go find provisions. And in this quest to find provisions, he slipped, he fell down an embankment and landed on his back in a local like lake, river, something like that. And as he's laying there in surprise, apparently this giant Cardassian pops up out of the water, like I would imagine, I guess, like a massive alligator or some nonsense, you know. And just kind of scares him. And they both kind of scare each other, you know, just a surprise of the moment. Apparently, this Cardassian had been bathing and, caught it by surprise. They both go for their guns. They both go for their weapons. Lee is a bit quicker on the draw, and he's able to kill this Cardassian before he can really do anything. And here he was, soaking wet, in his underwear, unprepared, surprised Cardassian, taken down by Lee Nullis. The story then gets twisted around, retold, refashioned multiple times, and by the time, before Lee realizes it, He is a hero. He had this glorious hand-to-hand combat with this infamously terrible Cardassian, and he won. And everybody is just elated to tell this story. And he, and but to Lee, he's like, all I did was shoot an unarmed Cardassian in his underwear.
Right.
And now Sisko tries to kind of like console him and can, and you know, like help him to see that this is what Bajor needed. They needed this kind of hero worship in order to pull themselves through a very rough time for all of the people on the planet. This kind of helps Lee to realize that it's not so much the accuracy of the tale of what he did that's important, but more of what he's come to symbolize for his people. And so he's decided that he will assume the role and he will do whatever is necessary.
Right.
Lee then ends up going to Bajor, and when he returns, he is accompanied by, again, First Minister Jaro and Jaro Asa. And Jaro announces that they have made a new title for Lee, and by unanimous vote, he is to become the Navark, which is a new title, which basically makes him, like, next in line for command under Sisko. All right, and I almost kind of took it as he's not even next in line, but he's essentially on the same level as Sisko. Like, he is the Bajoran equivalent of Sisko on the
station.
We
didn't quite hear what the role means yet, but okay. Yeah. All right, go ahead.
We don't really understand what it means, but it, one thing we do know that it means is that we no longer need Major Kira.
He's now the new liaison officer.
So he is now the new liaison officer. We no longer need Kira. Kira is to be immediately reassigned. And so now we've lost our one of our other favorites, Major Kira, to be replaced by Navark Lee Nullis. And Sisko is left without any kind of explanation as to what happened. And that's it. That's the episode. To be continued.
Yes. Yeah.
What a great season opener.
Yeah. Yeah, a great little cliffhanger there at the end. Like, it's not a bad thing. We like Lee Nullis. We like that he's the Navark. We don't think he's wrong to be promoted to that position. And we're happy to have him return to the station. But why does Major Kira have to be let go in order for all this great stuff to happen? Can't she stay too? Can't we have a second liaison officer? Can't she do the day-to-day nitty-gritty and he is, like, basically a figurehead of some kind? It was a good little cliffhanger for the end of our first episode of season two.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is one of those things that I love so much about Deep Space Nine, which kind of, you know, the other shows didn't really do a lot of. Now, cliffhangers are a part of Star Trek. Like, every franchise has done them. But to start your very first episode of the season as a multi, you know, arced story like this was unheard of. And they give us so much. Like, this episode jumps right into the action. We've got a prison break, basically. We've got covert ops, lying to Cardassian operators, making up people. We've got new aliens we've never seen before. The alien that gave Quark the earring. She's what's known as a Boslik. Never seen him before.
Right.
Got him now. We have the talks of nationalism, xenophobia. There's a rogue group that's already on the station and is working covertly. And, you know, that's another one of my favorite scenes in here where Sisko and Odo and Sisko, Odo, and O'Brien are standing there. And Odo's like, I wouldn't be too concerned. This is a low priority, low security area of the station. Sisko's like, now on, there are no low security areas. I'm like, yes, that's right. You know, and it makes you also realize again how big the station is. It can be so large. They have areas that are rarely ever trafficked, and things like this can happen. So obviously there's going to be a brush up in security. So we get a lot here in this episode. We're finding out a lot. We find out about the political unrest on Bajor, that it's global. It's not just in one particular area, anything like that. Kira lays it out for us. The main, you know, the main continents, and even down on the southern islands, there's people just revolts happen everywhere. So we know that there's a lot of unrest going on. And we also get to see the importance of heroic figures like Lee Nullis. If Kira really believes that this is the person to unify an entire planet, this guy must be something special. And we see that too when he does come onto the station and he's all dirty and, you know, he hasn't changed his clothes and everything else. People are already, they recognize him and they're willing to follow him. The man's been in prison for 10 years and yet he is so well known. He's so famous. He's already drawing a crowd.
Right.
I mean, there's obviously a lot going on here and it's a great cliffhanger and it makes you just, you want to watch more. And I mean, I don't exactly remember this one when it first came out. Like, I don't remember watching it per se then. Like, I did. But I can't imagine watching such a great opener episode and having to wait a whole other week to find out what was going on. Like, thank God for syndication, because I would have lost my mind if I would have had to wait.
Thank goodness, you know. Netflix drops their entire seasons in one go, right?
Yeah.
Except then when they have a cliffhanger at the end of the season, you have to wait a whole year, like every other show in all of all time, for the next season to come out.
We just need to start signing up actors, especially on great shows, sign them up and be like, you know that this means you're locked away for the duration of the show. Like, you live here.
Yes.
And you'll be filming until it's over. You will live this. We're no longer letting you go to acting school. Everything is method. You must live, immerse yourself in our world, and you don't get out until we're done.
Right.
That'd be an interesting way to film a show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But what did you think? What did you think? What did you think of this episode?
Well, it's basically what I've been asking for. It's starting to build the more Bajoran focused kind of serialized storytelling. This episode follows perfectly on the season finale of season one. That one was about the Bajoran religion and how that brings in conflict with the Federation. This one is the political end. The politics of the planet Bajor are in turmoil, and that's causing xenophobia, and they need a leader. And so the Federation, through Sisko, allows themselves to kind of get drawn up a little bit into the politics of Bajor by going and rescuing one of their prisoners of war. And I know this is going to be a 3-part episode, so I look forward to how episodes 2 and 3 of this 3-part episode play out, which is fantastic. Most episodes, if they're like a 2-parter, it's, you know, 2 episodes. So 3 episodes tying together, I mean, gosh, it's like a mini season in and of itself. So yeah, this is gonna be this is more of what I wanted. So I'm really glad that this is happening. And I do want to say that I thought that Sisko being willing to give the runabout and risk Federation involvement in a prisoner, the Bajorans breaking out prisoners of war was a little bit risky. I do like how they explained it though, of how the Bajorans had been promised that they would have the prisoners of war back. And so if they pulled this stunt, the Cardassians would have nothing to be upset about. They would have to do exactly what happens. And when Gold Dukat just says, oh, hey, guess what, guys? We have some unexpected prisoners of war. We just found them. It was hilarious. You know, it's a great moment. And when she walks in and Sisko is just like, hey, before you say anything, would you like to listen to what the girl Dukat has to say?
So I've always taken it as, while obviously there was a concern that that Federation involvement of any kind, the runabout, the officer, you know, Miles O'Brien going in, that could cause issues for the Federation. I really always took this as, you know, part of the reason that the Federation is there in the first place is because they were invited by the Bajorans to help facilitate this transition from the oppressive regime of the Cardassians to a more stable and free Bajor under the guidance of the Federation. You know, ultimately guiding them towards Federation membership, sure. But for the most part, it's like, we're here to make sure that everybody abides by the rules of your newfound peace treaty, non-aggression pact, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
So to that end, that's why Kira could use a Federation runabout to get there. But that was why, while she could use a Federation runabout, a Federation officer in tow would be a bit more problematic, because him having to take part in any of the rescue attempts makes this worse.
Yes.
That's why he was like, that's why it was okay for her to take the shuttle, but right. That's why she threw up kind of a, you know, red flag about O'Brien joining her, because right. If he had to take part in anything as an active contributor, that would be different. So, right. I got that a little bit. But yeah, I mean, that's all made a moot point by, you know, Jadzia points out, according to the agreement, the Cardassians are supposed to turn over all of their prisoners a long time ago.
Right.
So now we've got 10 plus years of these people still being in prison. So yeah, what are they going to say to us?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Going back to O'Brien for a moment, I also thought that his agreement to go on this mission was a bit, well, I mean, like, he has a wife and child on the station. And when Kira says to him, like, this mission is either success or we die. Like, there's no, we're partially successful. There's like, either we get this done or we're captured and we die. So I was like, man, O'Brien is willing to, he's like, okay, yeah, I'm here to do the mission a little bit more easily than I expected. I guess what I'm getting at is that both Sisko and O'Brien in this episode are willing to be more risky and take more risks than I myself would have been willing to take, or that I am fully convinced the characters should be willing to take. But I know that the stories need plot to move ahead. And well, so, okay, we'll go with it. Let's make it happen.
Well, also in universe, there's always this undercurrent theme with Federation officers, Federation personnel in general, that part of the, I guess, how do I want to say this here? Part of the sign up when you join Starfleet is that there's an agreement made that you agree to put other people's needs way ahead of your own, right, up to the point of, yeah, you're sacrificing your life for it. So under no circumstances can you break these rules, can you do this, can you do that, like all of that stuff, even saying you're willing to die for these principles. And so right. This is a theme that does come up a lot in Star Trek, which, however noble it may sound, I always feel like it's one that falls flat whenever they go into execution, because they just don't explain it very well. They don't give us enough to help us to make that leap. And we as individuals, we're just not there yet. We are right. Very personal people, and to think of us ever being in a situation we're willing to give up our lives and sacrifice our families and all the rest of it for this high-minded greater good. I mean, again, it sounds great in theory, but in this, we're supposed to be seeing it in practice. And like I said, I feel like they always kind of fall flat on that. And you could be excused with this with O'Brien, because we don't really see him a lot, at least not lately, in that family role. Besides, I mean, we ended last season with his, you know, connection with Keiko, sure, but we right. didn't really see much of Keiko throughout all of season one. Our connection to her is tangential, to say the least. And, you know, she's obviously not there. She's not around. You know, so what's going on there?
Right.
You know, so it would help, I guess, to make decisions like this to seem a bit more impactful if there was more of an interaction. Now, I know that, you know, behind the scenes, the actress Rosalind Chow, who plays Keiko, she had a lot of other commitments that were going on. She was doing a lot of other things besides Star Trek. You know, right. That's why she couldn't really be as involved. But, you know, she's around. So
right.
There is that. But gotcha. Yeah, I agree. I think that they just, it's one of those things that, again, it sounds great, but they really needed to do more to make it worth it. Now, like, for example, if this was Sisko, and he was willing to lay down his life, I think that would be would have been a bit more impactful, because we know of his family connection, and we know already that he's already lost someone to this
right.
sacrifice of greater good. You know, his wife is already gone, and he's made such a big deal about protecting his son and raising his son. So for him to suddenly find something that he's willing to lay his life down for would have been way more impactful. But right. We're not there yet in season two. You know, right. we haven't gotten enough. So hopefully, as all the characters evolve, we will see more of this. So we'll go from there.
Right. I guess I just want to say that I wish it had been Dax that went along with Kara for this mission. Again, because I really do feel that Dax so far has not been given a lot to work with. I mean, even this episode, she's like barely there. Like, she's there to tell Cisco, like, a good reason for why they can go ahead and do it. But if, like, the plot hadn't been, oh, here's a pimp and his lady friend, it had been two girls coming, and, oh, we've been, both of us have been called here to meet the goal, whoever is in charge here. And, like, oh, and look, she's a different race. Like, you've had a Bajoran, but, oh, but you have had, and just kind of that stuff. I think it could have worked, because that whole scene, let me put it this way. I don't feel like O'Brien was the one who had to be the character to be the one that went with Kira, other than he's like a dude, and he's directly from the Federation. But I think that Dax could have filled that role just as well, and I just want her to have more screen time, and
right,
she hasn't had it.
But at least I feel like in those scenes that we do get with Dax in this one, I do feel like she was way more present than what we had seen of her in the entirety of season one. You know, this is right. First episode of season two, and already I feel like her presence is much stronger in this 2-minute scene that we get her in than we had in the entirety of season one. She's very upfront. She's very warm. She, you know, dives right into, you know, speaking her piece about what Cisco's asking her about. You know, she's great. And it just kind of highlights again how utterly wasted she was in season one, because there was very little, if any, of that. Right. And so it's like, I guess someone, hopefully, I mean, at this stage, it feels like someone took notice and said, you know what? We have got to bring this character to life. We have got to do more here, because such untapped potential can't just sit on our back shelf. And even though it's a little bit, you know, it's a great teaser to what is to come. So great on that.
Gotcha.
So in an episode full of powerful scenes, David, which was your favorite? Which stands out to you?
Well, if the most powerful scene, we have to go with when Lee Nalis, is that right?
Yes.
He tells the story to Cisco of how he became this famous mythological figure and how the legend of who he is grew. Because it totally makes sense. Like, he was just a guy desperate to survive, and he was in the right place at the right time to take out one of the leaders of their hated enemy. And his two friends only witnessed part of that interaction, the very end. And then when they retold the story, and it got retold and retold and retold and retold, it expanded into something way beyond whatever he had actually done. And so throughout this episode, you can sense that there's something about Lee Nalis that's off. He's not willing to – he doesn't come off as this great leader. He just comes off as a guy. He's just some person. And there's something like – he doesn't come off as like there's something like – it's like there's some secret – that's going to be revealed and like, oh no, he's actually a traitor or something. It's just like, no, he's a guy who's tired and he's a guy who's weary. And he's a guy who like whenever he sees, like when Bashir asks him about his time and like, you know, oh, I forget exactly what he says, but he basically says to Bashir, I don't want to talk about it. And when they go to, when Cisco takes him to his quarters, he's like, hey man, I was just in a prison labor camp for 10 years. These quarters are well beyond anything I've had to enjoy for a while. So I'm perfectly happy to be here. And then again, that story turns, he says that like every single success that the rebels would have were always attributed to him. And so, yeah, this man has been put in a position technically beyond his capabilities, or at least people treat him as being better than he knows himself to be. Again, he just was in the right place at the right time once upon a time. But Cisco makes a compelling case. He's like, well, what the people really needed from you was hope. They needed someone to embody their best qualities, and they made you that. And that is technically something you can do. You know, he reminds me in this moment of, you know, in fiction of great characters that we like who have, you know, leadership kind of thrust upon them. Great examples. Again, I love Ender's Game. I've talked about that. Ender kind of has leadership thrust upon him. Mm-hmm. Game of Thrones. We have Ned Stark. He doesn't want to be handed to the king, but he agrees to go. We have Jon Snow. He doesn't want to be a leader, but it's kind of thrust upon him. And in a lot of fiction, there's always this example of the best leaders are those who are on some level reluctant to take power. They recognize that they aren't quite up to the task. They are willing to put it down. They're reluctant to take it up. And so this is another one of those characters who falls in that line. And so we are, by the end of this episode, he has decided to take up the challenge after Cisco's encouragement. And so we are happy to see him do that and are ready to see more of him. And then suddenly, at the end of this episode, we find that his success is now going to be in conflict with Kira. Mm-hmm. And we need to find, we were hoping that there's going to be a resolution to that. As I said at the end of last season in our recap especially, we don't have a ton of Bajoran characters other than Kira in our regular roster. Mm-hmm. So actually, I mean, I would love for him to become a regular part of the cast. I know that he doesn't, just because, you know, like when you see the cast doesn't really update in future seasons necessarily. It's not the regular cast. But if that is what would happen or could happen, or at least he becomes more of a regular on some capacity, I'd be happy to see that. And then let's confront this myth of him. If he is not quite up to the task that the myth has made him out to be, how does he fail his legend? How does he fail the mythology that's been built up around him? And how does that affect the Bajorans? How does he help them grow? Does he truly work as a good, you know, it sounds like right now he's not a leader in the sense that he has real power. He's like a figurehead, like the Queen of England, kind of. But, I mean, the British people love the Queen of England. They definitely treat the royalty as if they have value in their society and culture. So if that's what Lee Nahlas needs to do for his people, maybe that's something we can work with.
It's a great way to introduce a character, that's for sure. I mean, Lee, the presentation of Lee here is very strong, and it's very well done execution, not just from the writing, but also from the acting. I mean, I really do, this actor, he makes a great show of not wanting to embrace this role. He's not trying to be the great Lee Nahlas or even the Navark, and he doesn't really know what that is. He's very humble throughout his entire process, but at the same time, he speaks up. Like, he didn't have any problem with coming up with the words that he needed, even though he didn't want to give the little speech in the Replimat, you know. Yes. But he did it anyway, you know, because he understood, even then, whether he really wanted to admit it or not, he did it anyway because he realized that that's what the people needed. Right. And I think that's also the message that Cisco tries to convey to him, and that he actually, you know, finally absorbs and embraces, is that he's what they need to move beyond a very difficult point in their development here.
It closes a chapter for them in some capacity. Yeah.
They've been oppressed for a long time. He was their mythical hero from that time. So we need to see him, of all people, move into a new way of living. And that's what I feel like Cisco's trying to impress upon him, saying that you can help give that to your people. You can bring them forward with us. And that's even kind of echoed because, you know, he talks about with Dax how he's been watching – this is Cisco here. He's been watching how all of the progress they've made over the past year is starting to unravel. And he's looking for some way to kind of unify everybody and bring them back, not just to – back to where they were, but to keep them moving forward. And he feels like Lee is that push they need. So, again, great introduction for a very important character. So, he may not become a part of the regular cast, but he may be a part of the recurring cast. He may be like Keiko, you know, and he just pops in, you know, when we need him most for something or whatever that is. You know, I mean, we've been kind of introduced to a couple of Bajoran characters here at the end. We've now got Vedic Barayel. We've got Vedic Wynn. Those are the ones that were introduced to us at the end of the first season. Yep. We now have, obviously, Lee Nahlas. We've got now First Minister Jero Essa.
We never
had that before. And now, I mean, the only real leadership we had seen so far was Kyle Paca. And now we've got all these other levels coming in here. So we are getting there. We are starting to see more of the Bajoran society, starting to flesh that out a bit more. We did the kind of religious part here in the end of season one. We're now starting to see a little bit more of the political and militaristic side here in the beginning of season two. So lots to work with in terms of characters and recurring roles here.
I do want to quickly say that in the episode Progress, where Kira has to interact with the stubborn farmer on that
Mullabak.
Moon. Yeah. There is a minister there who's sent up to, like, force Kira to get him to move off. But yeah, that guy, he's gone. And so, I mean, not that he was just there for the episode. But yeah, Jarrow Essa, played by the fantastic Frank Langella. Frank Langella, I mean, I don't remember all that I've seen Frank Langella in at the moment, but I definitely know he has a great face for looking just a teeny bit creepy. Like, he can play creepy characters. A little bit sinister,
right.
Yeah. So, like, nothing so far makes me think that he's a bad dude, other than, you know, at the end of the episode, he's the one who's like, all right, Kira, you're out. It doesn't say it that way, but, you know, yeah, like, if it turns out, like, he's kind of one of the failed leaders of the Bajorans, and therefore him promoting Lee Nalis to, like, a figurehead position, like, because he's using him, like, when Lee Nalis was having trouble giving his speech, you know, Jarrow Essa shows up and says, hey, do you mind if I'm a politician, this is a great moment, do you mind if I take the chance? And he gives a nice speech, he's like, hey, I want you to remember this moment, this is when Lee Nalis returned to us. You'll tell your children and grandchildren about this. So it's a great moment, and there's nothing wrong with the character. And I don't, you know, me being the optimist, I don't want any character to be bad. I want everyone to, in the end, turn out to be friends and work together, and I don't know, be nice. But if Jarrow Essa turns out to be some sort of antagonist on some level, he's definitely in a great spot for it. Mm. And I thought he was great in this episode for doing what he did. Have nothing wrong with him so far. No reason to hate him or dislike him, other than knowing that the actor can play a sinister, creepy character to perfection.
So Frank Langella has had a very long and storied career. Just for a little bit of background on him, he rose to prominence, of course, playing Dracula back in the 70s, and that kind of kicked things off for him. And then he eventually was playing Richard Nixon on Broadway. He's been nominated for an Academy Award a few times, but I don't think he's won. So yeah, he's got a lot of good acting cred, and I was just reading about him here and saying that, you know, he did this role as First Minister Jarrow because his kids at the time were great fans of the television series, and so he wanted to be a part of the thing that they liked. And he's actually, initially, he went uncredited for his role as Minister Jarrow because he said that he wanted to do it because it was something for his kids. He didn't want to be seen as taking it for any kind of promotion or money or anything like that. So he wasn't credited until much later. So there you go. I mean, pretty stand-up guy, despite the fact that you're right. He has this face that makes him seem like he's great at playing just this side of shady.
Yeah.
You know, not quite evil.
Yeah. I just want to say one fun thing. In my experience, the actors, and I don't know if this is true of Frank Langella, I'm just going to attribute to him just because, but in my experience, the actors who play evil characters are always the nicest people in real life. It's like the nice people know what it's like to be evil. For some reason, like, they're so good, they know what the exact opposite looks like. So I would imagine that's on some level true of him as well. Like, he's a nice guy, really great dude, but he can play evil to perfection. I don't know.
That does seem to be what they say about a lot of them too. It always, you know, whenever they do interviews about with these actors and stuff after they've played these very evil, dark, sinister roles, everybody on the cast is like, "Oh, they were such a lovely person to work with. They're such a sweetheart. They're such one." I was like, he just fake murdered like 30 people, so I don't know what you're talking about,
right?
You know, but yeah, he would definitely fall into that category for me as well. So I totally understand,
right. Yeah, I just also just saw that apparently he was Whoopi Goldberg's partner for a time, and she was on Next Generation as Guinan. So Star Trek
alums everywhere.
But I want to say also that the other great scene in this episode is, of course, Sisko and Jake.
Yes. Well, you knew we were going to return to that. That's like my bread and butter. I love these two so much. But yeah, go ahead. Go first.
I'll just say it. First off, Jake Sisko, who is played by
Ciroc Lofton.
There we go, Ciroc Lofton. In this episode, we've seen that he's grown. It's the finale. Like, he's nearly as tall as Avery Brooks, which is fantastic. And I think they cast them well together. Like, I totally believe that Ciroc Lofton and Avery Brooks are related on some level.
Yeah. Like, they look similar. Like, yeah. I've watched him many times, and I know that that's not his son and everything else, but seriously, like, he looks like him.
Yeah.
And I don't know if, like, they've done something to make him look that way or not. I can't imagine that they would, especially not for a kid. I can't imagine that they would, but he does.
I just think it's stellar casting. It's just some of the best casting. And then Avery Brooks just always sells the affection. Like,
yeah, he does.
He's always kissed him on the head. He's always like, even though he's the dad who, like, you can't go to the Holosuite, son, or you can't sit in private with your girlfriend, he's always still loving on him, and it's great. And
He's very affectionate with his kid. He's hugging him. He's showing that he's interested in what he's saying, even to the point of he sacrifices that with his other officers. Like, he couldn't care less what Kira is coming running up to him about.
Yes,
this is his son. This is his son's time, and this is important. Right. You know, and he pays him 100%, even to the point of when Jake leaves, Sisko was still looking after him. You know, and he's like, and he's just all holding on to it for just a moment longer.
Oh, and he's all giddy. Like, Kira's all anxious. She wants to tell him something, and he just goes and gets a cup of tea. And do you want tea? And then he goes gets like a dessert, and he all sits down. He's all like, me and my son are just having a great time. And Kira, what do you need? What do you want? And she's like, I don't want to tell you.
Right. You seem to be in a good mood. I don't want to ruin it. Yeah,
exactly.
But yes, as always, the scenes between the two of them really sell this, sell their relationship, and also just really kind of work to elevate the characters. Like, they play together so well, Jake and Ben. They work together so well that, I mean, it's almost the equivalent to me of Quark and Odo. The way that these two characters interact with each other, and it's so natural, it's so easy, it's just great to watch. And yeah, you're also right, Jake has grown significantly since the last time that we saw him, you know, which is just last season. He was featured in the last episode with the school and everything else. But he's a good deal taller than he was the last time we saw him.
Oh, spurt. Oh, my gosh.
And I don't know if they recognize that or not, and maybe that's why they put him in that ugly olive green jumper thing. I don't know where they're getting these from. They really need to stop immediately.
It's olive green and burnt orange. Like,
it was just...
And like, I don't know. We live here in Austin here, and it's, you know, the Longhorns, but burnt orange didn't work back on that TV screen for whatever reason. So.
It's just terrible, and I just don't know why they keep doing it, but man, that is just awful.
Yeah.
But other than that, great scene.
It's a great scene, and I guess I'll say it, you know, the moment where Jake is talking to his dad, like, oh, you know, the girl's father wouldn't let me date her because I'm not of the same race. Oh, man, we have a black actor with a black son talking about not being accepted for dating purposes because of race. Like, man, I don't know. Tell me about that. Do you know if that was a big thing back then?
Obviously it was. I mean, obviously this isn't just a problem central to the 90s. This has been going on for decades. And you know what? It still continues to go on. Despite, as you know, we've talked about movements towards multiculturalism and so forth, this is still a very prevalent issue. You know, interracial dating for some people is just absolutely a no-no. And even if you find in some way to try to cross that line, it can still be something that hounds the couple for as long as they're together, you know. Right. So having that kind of experience at such a young age, I mean, especially when, you know, for the most part of your life, you were never even thinking about dating, right? You're just making friends. You're running around. You're just kind of living your life as a kid, you know. But obviously, you grow up. Things you change. The way you look at things change, and to suddenly be conflicted by something as confusing as a block because of race, something that you simply can't change. It's a matter of biology that you look the way that you do, and there's nothing that you can do to change that whatsoever. And to have that be the limiting factor on who you can associate with, who you can love, who you can it's just it's heartbreaking. And you know, I understand Sisko here and trying to, you know, soften this for his son, and he's attempting to explain, you know, that this is, you know, born out of the xenophobia of a oppressed people treated the way that they were. But it's still a hard concept for a kid to grasp. Yeah. I mean, heck, it's a hard concept for a lot of people at a lot of different ages to grasp. So in the 90s, though, of course, we were seeing more of this sense of pride in self. And right. I know that in, you know, in Black communities, especially, you know, there is this undercurrent of trying to find a place not only where you identify, but you also feel comfortable. And right. that can be very hard to do when there are other people of other races around you or trying to influence that group who don't have your best interest at heart and who don't see you as an equal. And so to try to find a way to step out of that just for the sake of making friends, let alone also trying to establish romantic relationships, can be very hard.
Right.
And bringing home another person of another race on either side can be met with so much, not just racism, but also, you know, like there's skepticism, there's worry, there's all kinds of just emotions that are tied to that, even to the point of, you know, fear, you know, a young promising Black child bringing home someone of another race to their family. You know, yes, there's always going to be that worry. Oh my God, is this going to end up with my kid being, you know, harassed, hurt in some way? Like all of those things are a part of that. And, you know, Star Trek is attempting, as we see here, they're attempting to handle something that, one, is a very delicate issue. It's certainly a timely issue. And this is one of those things that also makes this show so timeless, because it's not an issue that we have solved yet. The show was filmed 30 years ago, and we still haven't really gotten any better at handling that, you know? And
we have since then, but I mean, I don't know. I haven't had your experiences. You tell me.
Yeah. So I'm going to stick by what I said. We haven't gotten, better.
Fair enough.
We haven't gotten better. I would like to think that there are some aspects that I guess you could say some things have improved when it comes to, like, I guess making friends or whatever, but there's always going to be in some corner of the group, whether that's on either racist side, there's always going to be this worry.
Right.
You know? And, I feel like this is, again, Star Trek attempting to bring to light an issue that really hadn't been highlighted before in any of their Trek shows, because there was never really a need to. They didn't have a Black lead, and they certainly didn't have a young Black male character like Jake running around trying to do things.
Yeah.
So there was a very kind of, if you want to use the term, you know, kind of a pristine, homogenous nature to the show, because anybody who looked different, they were aliens.
Right.
For the most part. You know?
Yeah.
So it's not the same as trying to raise a person through these very tumultuous times. So I'm glad that they attempted it. Did they nail everything as precisely here? No, but that's most likely because you've got people who probably were writing this who weren't totally aware of the situation. But also, you have to just kind of give things to time. There's only so much time they can give to certain aspects of a storyline. And, that one, while big, while important, way too heavy to unpack in a 42-minute episode show, and you got an A and a B plot. There's just no way to get to all of it. So,
well, you know, I just want to say two things. First off, I think it's great. This is a perfect follow-up to the end of last season, because Jake was also on the outs with the whole religious aspect. You know, he was one of the five students of Keiko's that were not Bajoran and therefore were abandoned by the Bajorans. When Keiko was in all the hot water. But I also want to say that I love the way that Sisko, you know, Ben Sisko says to Jake, he says, you know, there are some problems on Bajor, and I'm sorry that you, Jake, are a victim of those problems. It's not fair to you. He consoles him. There's nothing else he can really say. You know, he's like, I'm going to fix it. He doesn't say that. He says, yeah, you are unfortunately having to suffer some consequences that you had nothing to do with. It's not your fault. And Jake seems to be handling it well enough in the moment. I would like to see more of him working some of this stuff out as we go throughout the rest of the show. But for the moment, it was a good scene. It was one of those moments where, like, you're watching it and you're like, yeah, man, powerful for what it is, and look forward to more.
And I know that we'll get more, and you know, we'll see more attention paid to this development between them. And the other races in general, especially with the Bajorans, because obviously they're not going anywhere. So now we've talked multiple great scenes, so let's talk some not so great scenes.
Right? Okay.
Gotta always ask. So again, what stands out to you as just a totally, we didn't need it, and not even just that we didn't need it, but just, you know, it was boring. Like, I wish they had used that for, give more time to this other storyline instead, that kind of thing.
No, there's nothing I can think of in this episode. I think everything had its place. The opener was fantastic with Quark and Odo. Like, it doesn't have anything to do with the rest of the episode. It's just Quark quoting one of the rules of acquisition, and it's great. We get to, you know, Quark is a great character, and he's a Ferengi, and he loves being a Ferengi. Like, he doesn't apologize for who he is. He's gonna play those rules to acquisition to death, and Odo just has to keep figuring out how to work with Quark. As far as Odo knows, there's something up, but as far as he can tell, things are finally looking good with him and Quark, and Quark is just playing another angle. It's like a long game, you know, he doesn't have anything currently where he's working on, but, you know, give him a year or a couple months and he'll have some new scheme and he'll have Odo on his side for at least long enough for him to get something done, I would assume. So I look forward to that. But there's no scene that I don't think was, you know, misplaced. I think everything had its place in this episode.
Okay.
How about you? You agree?
For the most part, I mean, I'm still going to go back to the whole on the runabout, go Moraine.
Oh, right.
It's just so dumb to me because I'm just like, seriously, Google right. it. You could have checked like this.
It's like the scene needed some tension, so they threw in a little bit of tension, but it's really just filler when it comes down to it.
Yeah, it just did nothing for me. So yeah, I that one for me is when I'd just be like, either redo it and make it plausible for some other reason or just cut right. Just yeah. cut it, you know.
It's funny to watch Cole Meany and Nana Visitor play around on the computers like they're actually doing stuff. Like the actors, whether it's TNG or this, are always pressing buttons. They're always really busy pressing a lot of buttons.
And for the flat screens that we're supposed to believe that they are, they press with such emphasis.
Yeah,
you know, like they just really gotta work it in there, you know. And it's just like. You know, the only person that I've ever watched on Star Trek who I felt like did it and did it well was Data. And I don't know if that was like intentional because he's the android. But if you watch Data's motions, it just seems so fluid, so effortless, and he just kind of moves. And then everybody else, it just seems like they have to just kind of like, there's so much extra that's put into yes. doing it.
Though I think I know why it works for Data now that you mention it. It's twofold. He presses a series of buttons and then he's done. Like he doesn't just keep pressing and keep pressing and keep pressing. And then two, he can look up and also press buttons down in front of him. Like when you're looking at a screen, you're not watching your fingers press buttons when you're typing, but like, it's like everyone else is watching their typing while they press the type, you know, the buttons. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm thinking back and I'm pretty sure I've seen him for the most part. Like even when he's pressing things, he's still looking at his yeah, monitor true. In front of him. I mean, but it just, again, it just seems like the way that he manipulated his console was just better. Like, he right. just seemed to be more precise about it than everyone else. And
right.
and in watching Deep Space Nine, the one that stands out to me the most with this issue is Kira. If you ever watch Kira yes, pressing the keys, it's like she's really, like, digging her fingers in some grooves over there.
Yeah. As soon as you said it, she's the one I thought of. Yeah.
just like, is this because you're not familiar with Federation technology? Is that your way of selling that you don't know what's right. going to happen when you press a button? Because she just, I mean, she's her whole shoulder's into it when she's working it sometimes. I'm just like,
don't give yourself a backache there.
Right. Kira. You're going to break that console. You keep this up, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, she's definitely one that stands out to me on Deep Space Nine. Data stands out because he seems to be so effortless with it. Other crew members that seem to be effortless, I would say Geordi would also be another one who just seems to be able to, like, he does it with ease.
But for everybody else, he's always holding a tricorder, and he looks down and he presses a button. He looks at the tricorder, he looks down and he presses a button.
Yeah.
That's just Jordy in my mind.
He's just got it. I like it when he's sitting at the console and he's wheeling himself back and forth from station to station, you know, manipulating things. I like that. But yeah, other than that though, everybody else just seems to like have an issue there. So again, right. That scene to me just, it was a do nothing. We didn't need it. It raised more questions than it answered. I want to question those guards. Like, y'all, you couldn't take 30 seconds. Y'all were hassling them about some fluctuating power coil. You couldn't take like one, two more seconds to type in Go Moraine and see if that name popped up somewhere. That should have been an instant red flag. They made that up, but no, right. You know, they just, okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Now they were just on the edge of their sensor range, so they couldn't tell what kind of ship they were. And yeah,
just outside of visual range, so no need to activate the view screen.
Right.
So now you can't tell really what kind of ship it is. You can't see the people on the ship, and they've potentially given you a fake name, and you just waved.
And they're taking a long time to respond to every question you have. Right. They take like a full 10 seconds to like get back with you. Give us a second. We're going to discuss what our answer will be. Oh, yeah, here's our answer to your question. Yeah.
So, yeah, just a lot of things about that. I was just like, if that had been me, I would have checked. And I also feel like if I had been there, after the fallout, right? And, you know, Gold Ducat and everybody else investigating to find out how this happened. Then they'd be so wait a minute. You guys scanned a ship. You couldn't tell what kind of ship it was. You couldn't see anybody that was on the ship. And they gave you this fake name. And you didn't think to check. Execution. You're dead.
Yeah.
Just line them up. Firing squad. Because of you, we've lost our Bajoran workers. Like, thanks a lot, guys. Like, that's how that would have really ended. Throw them out the airlock.
Yeah,
you're not paying attention here at your post, but no. Yeah. So a lot more questions.
10 years hard labor
race
for you too. Yeah, mm-hmm.
You got to take their place. We lost all these. You got to take their place. Yeah. Something. Well, David, we have talked this episode to death.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's still more we could cover, but
still got two more episodes in this little threesome. Right.
We are out of time for this one, but we will be back to talk about part two and then also part three. The only three-parter episode that was not part of any kind of serialization yet.
Right.
From any show.
Wow,
so we'll be back to talk about that.
Cool.
So guys, as always, you can tune in and listen to us anywhere you listen to podcasts. I happen to like to listen to us on Spotify. We are The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. And of course, you can find us by the same name on your social media, Facebook, Twitter in particular. And you should. And like I said, we've got some great stuff coming up for you here in season two. So tune in, follow us, and enjoy. Until next time, take care of yourselves.
Thanks, guys.